Chapter 4, FM and Shortwave Years. One day, early in 1936, the phone rang in my office. That was one day when I should have stayed home and not answered my phone. Boss Morgan Murphy was on the line. He said he had just been reading the Wall Street Journal and had read of a man by the name of Major Armstrong who had invented a new kind of radio called frequency modulation. Morgan said, "I want one of those." Then he hung up. I was vaguely aware of Armstrong tinkering with a new kind of radio, but I knew nothing more. At that moment, I suddenly knew I had to design, build, and put on the air this new, and to me unknown, twist in radio engineering. In that organization, the last words you said were, "I don't know," just before you cleared out your desk and went out on the street looking for another job. Morgan did not keep people on the payroll who could not do things. In fact, in the unwritten contract I had with him, there was a paragraph which said, "No things." There were frantic telephone calls to radio engineers or radio amateurs, just about anyone, asking, "How does one design and build a frequency modulation, now abbreviated to FM, transmitter?" In the end, I got a 100-watt FM transmitter on a breadboard, as engineers say, and I hooked up to a homemade turnstile antenna, a short-wave antenna that had been invented by RCA engineers, clever devils that they are. And lo, I am on the air with an FM station. The frequency was 43 megacycles, which the FCC had just tossed in. The FCC boys were just as bewildered as the rest of us, wondering what the hell was going on out there in radio land. 43 megacycles was not being used by anyone, so go ahead, boys, and have fun. Now, FM station W9XYH was on the air broadcasting WEBC programs for the world to hear, except nobody heard it, as there were no receivers. Well, there was one. I found an engineering firm in New York called Radio Engineering Labs, who handmade one receiver which I gave to the boss. He used it at home, and at his summer home on Whitefish Lake, 30 miles south of Duluth Superior. And there was one more receiver which I made for myself. Might as well know all aspects of this new kind of radio, which was supposed to be static-free. And I guess it was, but static had always been an inherent part of radio, and besides, how many static-producing thunderstorms did we have in northern Minnesota anyway? So, what else is new? The years rolled along with this lone FM transmitter reaching out to nobody, but Morgan was not satisfied. The signal was not strong enough at his summer home, so now I had to design and build a high-power amplifier for the transmitter. Now came some expensive fumbling with high-power vacuum tubes and components. Money was no problem. Morgan had deep pockets, and he never questioned costs. He only questioned results. One problem that plagued me was exploding bypass capacitors. I would throw on the 3,000 volts, and there would be a tremendous explosion with parts of the capacitors exploding and rattling all around the room. I learned to be hiding under a desk when I threw the power switch. About that time, I visited the General Electric Labs in Schenectady, New York, where I met H.P. Thomas and other top engineers, and I mentioned my exploding capacitor problem. They laughed and showed me the interior of one of their television transmitters, all pitted with marks of exploding capacitors. The GE boys were working on television then, but the frequencies and powers were the same as FM. This was 1940, and General Electric was interested in TV, but not FM. The big boys up top realized the big bucks were going to be in TV, and not in piddling little FM. So the power of W9XYH was increased, and my homemade turnstile antenna was moved up 350 feet above the ground on the WEBC tower. And now the signal went way out there, and nobody heard it. Well, a few did. But now a few FM receivers were coming on the market, but who paid much attention? After all, the programs were the same as WEBC's, so what else is new? Then came the war. World War No. 2, that is, and the station continued to grind out power, but with power reduced 10%. The FCC ordered all radio and TV stations to reduce power 10% to conserve power and to prolong the life of transmitting vacuum tubes. The war ended, and now Morgan wanted more power and greater range. So we entered the new phase in FM broadcasting. I applied to the FCC for permission to move W9XYH to a new 550-foot tower to be located on top of the hill behind downtown Duluth, and to increase power to 50 kilowatts, a bold move to be sure, but Morgan clung to his belief in this new kind of broadcasting. The FCC almost immediately granted me permission to increase power and to move, and assigned new call letters, WDUL. That's when the FAA stepped in. Their Chicago office said no one is going to put up a 550-foot tower at that location, right off the end of Duluth Airport runway 09, even though the tower would be some miles downrange. I sat there remembering my unwritten contract with Morgan, which required me to do things. I got on the train that night and went to Chicago and to the FAA office there, calling on the man that had signed that no-no letter. I was prepared to argue, but the secretary only shook her head. Too bad, but he had been called to St. Louis and would not be back for several days. What to do now? I had come all the way to Chicago and no one to argue with. I asked her if there was anybody else whom I could talk to, and she said, well, there is Mr. Douglas, the head of the entire Midwest FAA district. So, may I speak to him? And she said, yes. And I walked in and had the nicest conversation with a real top-level man. As we parted, he said, I'll see what I can do. A couple months went by as I sat in my office bleeding in my shoes. Then it came, the FAA approval and a quick telephone call to J.F. Neary at the American Bridge Company in Pittsburgh, telling him now to ship that 550-foot tower waiting there for us. The tower arrived, and then the steelworkers began erection. When it was about 200 feet up, a Mr. Olson came storming into my office. He was manager of the Duluth Airport, and by gum, nobody, and he meant nobody, was going to erect a radio tower in line with runway 09. He had been taking off on 09 that morning, and lo, there was a tower aborning right on his path. I got out the FAA approval signed by no other than Mr. Douglas himself. Olson was crushed, but he left my office without taking a poke at me as he appeared about to do so. What had happened was quite clear. Olson may have received a notice from the FAA telling him they were about to approve an erection of my tower, giving him 10 days in which to enter a protest. But Olson, like many airport managers, was first a pilot, and second, an office manager. And I suppose he hardly ever bothered to read his mail. Now, the tower went up, and I installed a 10,000-watt RCA-FM transmitter. The war was over, and I had all but closed my manufacturing shop in Superior, and I was purchasing factory-made equipment instead of building the equipment myself. And now, the frequency had changed to 92.3 megacycles, one of today's FM frequencies. And WDUL was pumping out 62 kilowatts of power all over the landscape with almost no listeners. Television was on the way, and few people were interested in just some more radio. Now came bus casting, whereby Duluth Superior City buses were equipped with FM receivers tuned to WDUL, providing bus riders with music. Wow! Now maybe FM will amount to something. My top engineer, T.O. Jorgensen, designed a special FM receiver, and a bunch of those were manufactured. Jorgie, his nickname, designed a microphone which picked up the noise of the bus motor and regulated the loudness of the loudspeakers so they were at a normal level when the bus was stopped, but with greatly increased volume when the bus was moving and noisy. In other words, the bus riders always heard the broadcast no matter how noisy was the bus. That included hearing the radio ads, which was the purpose of the whole thing anyway. Now, WDUL had a mission. But the mission died aborning. Bus riders found themselves as a captive audience, with no way to turn off the music and ads, and they rebelled. and the receivers were taken out of the buses and it was all over. It was about then that Morgan ordered WDUL shut down, and the transmitter building and the tower were vacant. The whole FM experiment, now about 15 years old, had continuously lost money, and it was not in Morgan's nature to lose money. He may have been bitter about the whole thing, but he never said anything, at least not to me. But we were not alone in experimenting with bus casting. It was being tried in other cities, in Minneapolis and in Cincinnati, and other places. I made a trip to both Minneapolis and Cincinnati, sitting on buses observing their operations. Endless riding on buses in both cities. I was impressed, and had told Morgan so. Now it is 1950, and along comes a New York crowd who bring television to the head of the lakes. They lease space in the WDUL transmitter building and on the tower, and they leased space in the WEBC studio and offices. They put their TV station, WFTV, on the air using UHF Channel 38, and they blasted away with great publicity. They are bringing TV to TV-hungry Twin Ports people, and the venture bombs. Channels 3 and 6 had not yet come on the air, but here was a UHF channel with few receivers and fewer yet interested, and advertisers found they were advertising to nobody, and they pulled out. And so did the New York people. When the New York engineers were installing the TV broadcasting equipment in the WDUL building on top of the hill, one of the engineers got across 3,000 volts and was thrown across the room and flat on his back. Laying there, he found he could hear everything being said but was paralyzed, unable to talk or to move. He reported later he heard the crew saying, "He's dead. There's no use calling an ambulance. Call a hearse instead." He lay there trying desperately to tell them he was alive and help me. In the end, they called an ambulance and he was wheeled off to the hospital where, after some desperate work, they brought him around. There was a coolness between him and the rest of the crew after that, and in the end, everybody went back to New York. The new TV station not only leased space at the WDUL site, but also studio and office space from WEBC. In their quarters in the WEBC building. But friction developed between the sophisticated New York TV people and ordinary WEBC radio people. So, the WEBC crowd, studying the lease, found the New York people had leased space at WEBC, but had not leased the office furniture. So, came that morning, the New York crowd showed up for work at 8 o'clock and discovered their desks and chairs were gone. Contents of the desks lay on the floor. Now they would have to conduct their business sitting on the floor. There were angry words and much studying of the lease by New York lawyers, and in the end, some desks appeared and the TV station continued to operate. By then, relations between the New York crowd and the WEBC employees had now gone from bad to hopelessly bad. Then came that day when they packed up and went back to New York with no happy memories of Duluth. But they had not been the first to bring TV to Duluth. I did. It was 1948 or 1949 when I leased a TV camera from RCA in Camden. I set it up in the largest WEBC studio and piped TV pictures down Superior Street by coaxial cable with tap-offs into stores along the street. We would send pictures down the street mostly during the noon hour when office employees were circulating around and they stopped in those stores and saw this new marvel, television. Programs were all live, with mostly interviews, including one gorgeous blonde interviewer who sat through an entire program interviewing a woman who was describing horrible scenes from the Korean War then in progress. The blonde was paying no attention to what was being said and sat there grinning into the camera the whole time. But the blonde did not grin into the camera the next day. In fact, she was not even there. And there was this one time when the WEBC people announced a grand show. At 1 p.m. on that day, everyone was invited to come downtown and see themselves on TV. I was to set up our one leased TV camera in a store across the street where the public could come in and see themselves on a monitor receiver sitting by the camera. 10 minutes to one, and all is well. A crowd is gathered on the street peering in on our studio through a big plate glass storefront. The crowd included several of WEBC's competitors. Then suddenly the screen went dark. The camera had conked out. It must be a tube in the camera. Tubes had a way of failing at inopportune times. I frantically began yanking out tubes, replacing them with spares I had on hand. Tube after tube, and as fast as I could, not bothering to determine which tube, all 32 tubes, with tubes and tube cartons scattered around on the floor. With all tubes replaced, with a prayer, I turned on the power and on came the picture. I earned my salary that day. But for some reason, never explained to me, Morgan showed no interest in television in the Twin Ports. Later, he was interested in TV in Madison, Spokane, Washington, and other places, but never at home. And channels 3 and 6 came on the air in Duluth and were very successful. But I had left the Morgan Murphy organization by then and was no longer interested. About shortwave. It was along about 1936 when the phone rang in my office with Morgan on the line. He said he heard the FCC was now permitting broadcast stations to have a shortwave station in the same market broadcasting the same programs as the mother station. He said, "I want one of those." And then he went on to think about other more important things. But now I had a new job, to design, build, and put into operation another broadcast station. I found the FCC was licensing stations on 26.1 megacycles, and in the industry they were called apex stations. Why, I never knew. Designing a shortwave station was no problem. I had been an active radio ham since I was 15 years old, building my own ham equipment, receivers, and transmitters. Time went by, and a transmitter took shape with the FCC limit of 1,000 watts. Not much power, but on short waves, a little power went a long ways, like all over the United States. This power was fed into what radio engineers called a J antenna on the 80-foot pole beside the WEBC transmitter. Call letters were W9XJL, and letters poured in. The transmitter repeated WEBC programs entirely, and avid listeners in faraway places thrilled to hear Twin Ports news, especially those who habitually fled the cold Minnesota winters to live in Florida, Arizona, and California. One such letter was from the engineers at the Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. They said they were continuously monitoring W9XJL signal, measuring signal strength day and night. So, at least the station had a purpose. But why Morgan wanted it on forever remained a mystery to me. He never explained. And, of course, I never asked. You never asked Morgan Murphy questions. You only listened. One time, early on, I mildly questioned some decision he made, and he explained to me. He said, "Charlie, I just don't have time to explain all the factors that went into my making my decision. So just do it." And I never questioned him again about anything. And you notice I kept my job for 28 years, and it was my idea in the end to leave. Many capable men and women came and went in that time, but I was always there.